Stephen De Silva is back in the studio. I'm delighted to welcome you, Stephen.
Thank you.
Stephen is a guide at the Cathedral, St. Albans Cathedral, a teacher in his spare time, long-time interest in history, and obviously knows everything there is to know about it. So I thought, having looked at the story of Alban and the role of the cathedral in Magna Carta, the pre-Magna Carta meeting, and various other things that we looked at, including the later rebuilding and so on, and who's buried where, and all sorts of other things that we've done, we want to look at that bit in between. After all, it was a monastery at one stage. Well, most of us don't quite know what it would have been like, because not much of it is left today. So where did all this start? I mean, obviously it was a critical site for anybody to select, but who chose to come there? Why?
Well, we know that there were pilgrims visiting the Church of St. Alban right from the really early days. We then enter that period of English history called the Dark Ages, where there isn't a lot of written detail. But there are hints that King Offa of Mercia, in the year 793, comes to St. Albans and builds a monastery, founds a monastery. But rather tantalizingly, some of the references say there were monks and nuns already living there. So in this period of the Dark Ages, had this holy place already been attracting people who wanted to live together in community, to spend their lives in prayer? The trouble with the details, the charter that says that King Offa founded the monastery, is that it's a much later document, and it's difficult to say with absolute certainty that he did so. I was listening to a historian recently who said perfectly likely that he did so, because King Offa needed to set himself up as a European king, and a good way of being a European king is to have patronage, to have a saint who is associated with you, and Alban would have been a great choice for King Offa to be associated with. He was quite a rival of some of the Kentish kingdoms, and Canterbury, of course, had St. Augustine and all the traditions down there. So Offa probably did adopt St. Alban and St. Albans as one of his personal projects.
Let's just set the timing context here, because we're talking about what century are we now in with.
So tradition says 793 is the year that Offa founds the Benedictine Monastery of St. Alban. But as I say, he takes something that's there and reshapes it into a Benedictine monastery. Benedict was the great European founder of monasticism, a great scholarly man. Benedictine monasteries were associated with scholarship, with teaching, with the production of fine manuscripts in their later stages.
By the time that we're talking about here, which may or may not probably was Offa, pilgrimages were going on already. There were pilgrims were coming to the site?
It looks like, again, reconstructing things like archaeology and coins, it looks like there's a relatively steady flow of pilgrims, which thins out in the 500s and 600s, and then picks up again in the 700s and 800s onwards, which fits again the dates that were given for roughly when this monastery is refounded. So there may have been a thin little trickle of pilgrims in the 500s and 600s. So pilgrims kept coming, but the re-establishment of a monastery, in other words, having a team of people who could care for the shrine of St. Alban, house Alban's bones in something beautiful that could be visited and honoured, that seems to have been re-energized around about the year 800.
Presumably they had to find the bones first.
They did indeed. I guess the tradition of where they were probably would have been kept alive as an oral tradition. We're not sure. And there was always the debate about, you know, relics. Were the relics that were housed in the Middle Ages the things that were there originally? I think with Alban, we stand a better chance than with many of saying there might have been a surviving memory. This ruined church that the steady trickle of pilgrims visited, probably the site of the burial of Alban would have been one of the remembered and honoured spots, even if it was a ruin.
Because it was on a hill.
And highly remembered after the destruction of the monasteries, somewhere like Walsingham in Norfolk, which has no shrine for several hundred years. Nevertheless, we know people visited Walsingham. They went to it. There was a nostalgia for the old days. You know, even Shakespeare talks about the bare ruined choirs where monks once sang. So I think I can accept the idea that there was a memory of where Alban's house was, where Alban's home in terms of his physical burial was. I think it may have survived in people's memories. Certainly there's a reinvention, if that's the right expression, of Alban in the around about 800.
Villages like St. Michael's were, as we see them today, if there's anything there was very little there.
Very little there. So the parish churches of Michael, Stephen and Peter are all founded by the monastery, by one of the Saxon abbots, who also founds the market in St. Albans, which is carried on to this day. So this Saxon period, you can see a flourishing, really, of a community, a confident community growing and building. And these three little churches become almost like little pilgrim churches where people did the final stage of their journey to the St. Albans Shrine. Those three churches have just produced a modern-day pilgrim's leaflet, encouraging modern pilgrims to visit one of those parish churches and make their journey to St. Albans Shrine.
So the town itself wasn't particularly big at the time.
No, we're looking at a very small community, and really even up to the point of the Reformation, in a sense, the abbey is the great focus of the town. There is a town obviously thriving outside the abbey gates, but the abbey is the raison d'etre for St. Albans.
So if there was a religious place where there was a church or a ruin or the beginnings of a monastery, then what does Offer or whoever it is maybe building this, what does he have to build?
He has to build a church for them, a Saxon church, which we have some fragments of, but no real idea of how big it was. He has to build things like dormitories to house them. There would have been rudimentary medical facilities and some kind of infirmary. There will have been practical things like kitchens. There probably would have been the very early stages of a farm to supply food for the monks living there. So in effect, he builds a small town. And that's what these big monasteries were. They were complete enclosed communities with all of their needs attended to. I mean, the monks at St. Albans eventually did go out and mingle very much in the town of St. Albans, but they could be self-sufficient within the walls of the monastery.
And were they covering what we would say the land around the abbey now?
Yes, if you stand outside the abbey now, the cathedral now, and you have your back to the cathedral looking down the hill towards Verulamium Park, that whole hillside was covered in buildings. These were the abbey buildings. They stretched as far as the great gateway, which does still survive outside St. Albans School, right down to the bottom of the hill. There was an enclosed wall enclosing all of that area. Today, if you go on, and you've probably seen the pictures on a nice dry summer, take an aerial photograph, you can see the outlines of these buildings going down the hillside. Those buildings were a crucial part of what the monastery was. So in the Middle Ages, when people talked about the monastery of St. Albans, they weren't necessarily thinking about the church. You're really talking about the community of St. Albans, the community of monks.
And it wasn't just monks, because there were nuns as well.
Yes, there were. The earliest records indicate there were female religious houses as well, but they were separated out very early in the Saxon period, and the female religious nuns seem to have been dispersed into smaller houses. There doesn't appear to have been one large central female religious house. So in a way, typical of perhaps male history, the abbey itself, the male monastic house, becomes the dominant feature of St. Albans.
Because one of the features of the area is there's a river down the bottom of the valley.
Yes.
And that's it was very important then.
Yes, navigable. We're told that things could be offloaded at a wharf down at the bottom and brought
up. Which presumably
up.
Is where the pub, the Fighting Dogs.
In that area, yes. Yeah. Some of the things in the cathedral are really interesting. The tower ceiling has Baltic oak in it. How did oak from the Baltic get to St. Albans? People have speculated. Was it ballast and ships coming in? You know, there's all kinds of debate about how these things reached the cathedral.
Now, that river ran from way out up in towards Bedfordshire, as it were.
Up into the Chiltern somewhere. Yes.
There were habitations. I mean, where Kingsbury is now, was it a small town?
Yes, there was. And it claimed royal patronage. And it was a real thorn in the flesh of the Abbot of St. Albans, because the Abbot of St. Albans is the real landowner. And so, in a way, all the tenants around and about should look to the Abbot as their lord and master. And of course, Kingsbury claimed to be a little royal, free borough, and it was a thorn in the flesh to the abbey and the abbots, and eventually Kingsbury is razed to the ground, and the annoying citizens, the abbots are very rude about them. If you read the deeds of the abbots of St. Albans, wonderful book, which has just been completely translated into English, they regard the Kingsbury lot as mere vagabonds, really, you know, causing theft and murder, and they're accused of all sorts of things. I mean, you know,
stealing fish, I imagine.
Stealing fish from the fish
ponds. The fish went past Kingsbury before it got to the...
They would have probably leapt the fences and got into the abbey fish ponds and stolen there. They would have hunted on abbey land at night, poaching in effect. but also generally were disrespectful to the monastery. I suspect they didn't tug their forelocks enough for the abbots of St. Albans.
This is something that then goes on right through history, doesn't it?
Absolutely. It leads to all kinds of things in the 1380s, where not just Kingsbury, but the whole of St. Albans, the whole of England, stops tugging their forelocks.
The authors that give us the picture of this, who are they? I know of one name, Matthew Paris.
Yes.
When was he writing?
So he's writing in the 1200s.
Right, looking back at all of this.
I've just mentioned this book called The Deeds of the Abbots of St. Albans. The abbey, like many great monastic houses, had what we call historians or chroniclers, and they kept a chronicle of the history. Now, The Deeds of the Abbots is a very substantial document, abbot by abbot, telling us what they did, passing a judgment on them. Were they good or bad? Most of them get the seal of approval of people like Matthew Paris. Matthew is a chronicler not only of the abbey, he writes other chronicles too. He writes chronicles about England and Europe. So he's a really important historical record for this period.
Was he a monk himself?
He was a monk at St. Albans. Highly well thought of, advisor to the king. And when the king visits the abbey, he often wants to talk to Matthew. Matthew's regarded as a very important person. And there are others, Walsingham and others, all kinds of people who were in the tradition of chroniclers. This chronicle of the deeds of the abbots, it starts to peter off towards the 1400s. But even then, you still have powerful abbots and their stories being written down. John of Wethamsted in the middle of the 1400s, perhaps the last really big, powerful abbot of St. Albans. But even the ones who come after him still have some influence. And all the way along, the abbey chroniclers in their scriptorium, the little part of the abbey where the scripts are literally written, are chronicling and recording and saying, and in this abbot's time, this was built and that happened. It's not history as we know it today. It's not objective. Abbots are judged on all kinds of things. Usually, were they good or bad? And the city and the town is judged on whether it was obedient to the abbey or not. So, you know, somebody like the citizens of Kingsbury that we were just talking about, well, they're terrible because they don't show due respect. Same thing happens at several periods in the history.
So it's a mixture of who's in power, who's controlling the situation, plus what they've heard, because it wasn't all written down. They weren't taking a lot of documents out of Wikipedia and putting
them
together.
No. Matthew was always fascinated. Matthew Paris is always fascinated when visitors come. Remember, the monastic houses of Europe sent people from house to house. So the idea of just English monks only living in an English abbey or Spanish monks living in a Spanish abbey, that's nonsense. They travelled from place to place. So several nationalities may be represented. They had the common languages of Latin and others, which would have allowed them to talk to each other. And Matthew, we know that whenever somebody visits the abbey, Matthew, I'm sure, pinned them down and said, so what have you heard in your journey here? It's taken you 6 months to get here from wherever. Tell me what you've heard. And we get all lovely snippets of history, some of which are verifiable, some of which completely aren't. Wonderfully gossipy sometimes as well.
Benedictines were not a silent order or anything specific.
No, they kept a greater silence, like all the monasteries, and much of the day was in silence, but they didn't have a complete vow of silence, no, because they were working together, as I say, producing manuscripts. So in the 1100s and 1200s, St. Albans Abbey is a great source of beautiful manuscripts. Some of the most beautiful in Europe are produced at St. Albans. So you can come in and see our beautiful facsimile of the St. Albans Psalter made for Christina of Marquiate. Beautiful document. Just gives you some idea of the quality of what was being produced. They were doing that. They were probably teaching, so taking in young postulants who were going to become monks and teaching and educating them. They operated, I suppose, for want of a better expression, a basic social services care for people. So if you did have an illness, the monastery was probably the place that you went. There was a basic form of medicine, often herbally based medicine, so clearly nothing like we would think of today, but you stood a chance of being treated at the monastery. Their prime purpose was prayer. We forget that. We think of them doing all these other things. Remember that they prayed 7 times a day, plus going to Mass. I think the analogy I would use is like a huge power station. In the Middle Ages, you prayed. You prayed to God. God was a given. Not everybody could take time out to pray because you were busy. You were trying to feed your children and till your fields and whatever else. But the monks were there to pray for you. So it was almost like they were praying on behalf of the country, on behalf of the nation. So I use the analogy of a power station, you know, this huge focus of prayer going up to God on behalf of everyone else. And lots of lay people, particularly the, I suppose, I don't like the word middle classes, but I think that's probably what they were, the beginning of the middle classes. They want to be associated with that prayer. And so the fraternity of St. Alban, today we have the Friends of the Abbey. The earliest form of that was the fraternity of St. Alban. Lots of lay people want to be associated with the Abbey, and they become members of this great fraternity. And the Abbey promises in turn to pray for them every day. So it becomes a relationship between these monks who are praying for the community and the community supporting those monks.
Give us a picture of the buildings. We've built the church, the abbey.
Yes.
And there are certain scriptorium within that abbey.
The scriptorium is probably on the south side because you wanted good light to do these manuscripts. Remember, people would be working by candlelight or daylight. And so the scriptorium was towards the south. In fact, virtually all the monastic buildings are to the south side anyway. But the scriptorium would have been positioned in an excellent area. We know that the cloister, and you can see the remains of the cloister arches on the side of the abbey building. Go and look at the cathedral today. There's a little sign explaining what you can see. The cloister was an open square, which was almost like a social hub. You could walk around the cloister. You could, as a monk, just be reciting your psalms, but you might also, during periods of conversation, walk companionably around the cloister having a chat with one of the other monks. We know that in the summer period, sometimes the scriptorium moved to the cloister. In the cloister, open to the sunlight, bright sunlight, do your work in the cloister there. As I say, a large dormitory. Originally, all the monks slept in a dormitory as we think of today, a school dormitory. But eventually, little cubicles were introduced, and each monk would have had their individual cubicle, which would have been very sparse, probably a pallet on the floor to sleep on, a bench, and maybe a desk at which they could read, or on which they could keep a prayer book or two. So a dormitory. The infirmary, we've already mentioned. The chapter house, which was the business centre, so that's HQ, chapter meeting. The abbot calls all his monks together and they sit and discuss. And
would that be a circular?
Well, the one that you see today is built on the footprint of the medieval one. So the rounded end, the apsidal end, is still there in the modern chapter house today. The one at Westminster Abbey is, in fact, circular. And then, of course, a large refectory where people gathered for meals. And meals were sparse, usually only two meals a day. Meals were consumed in silence. So the monks did keep some of the day silent. And during meals, usually there were religious readings or improving readings read out by a monk, perhaps at a lectern, and everyone else carried on eating.
Then they'd be muttering, "Not vegetables again."
We think that some sign language, some very basic sign language, came from this period. If you come into the cathedral, we've actually illustrated some of them. We know that there were certain things you could do. So if you wanted somebody to pass you some bread, you made a circle using the thumb and index fingers of both hands. That was bread. If you wanted vegetable stew, you made the hand signals for cutting up vegetables. You're taking one hand and slicing it across the other hand as if you were cutting up vegetables, which meant pass the stew. And then, of course, just putting your finger in front of your lips if you wanted silence. And that one's remained with us today. So we do know monks had developed these little ways of communicating with each other. The greater silence happened after the last prayer of the day, Compline. And after Compline, a greater silence was kept all night long until the first prayers of the next morning. So it was important that, in a sense, there was a complete silence at certain times of the day and night.
You mentioned the gatehouse. What was that for?
Well, the gatehouse was built really originally as just a fortification for the abbey itself. You could argue that it's being built as a way to formally welcome grand people. So the abbot's lodging, where the abbot lived. Now, the abbot did not sleep in the dormitory. The abbot had his own house. The abbots were quite grand of St. Albans. And the abbot's house was not far from the gatehouse. So you can imagine the king turning up. The abbot goes and stands in the gateway to ceremonially greet the king. So building a huge, great gateway like that was, fortifying the abbey, but it was also a statement of status. You know, to have a grand gateway in which the abbot could greet his important guests was something about the status of the abbey as well. And remember, that big gateway that we see today would have had walls on either side of it. You can still look at the side of the gateway, the one nearest the abbey, and you can see where the boundary wall fitted there. So the whole of the abbey enclosed by a boundary wall. that's a wall that is often assaulted by the townspeople when they don't like the abbey.
We talked earlier about it being sort of history seen from the men's side, as it always is, which is why it's called history. The nuns, did they have girls that they taught?
We know that they were involved, again, in social care. For example, leprosy or skin diseases. They may not be leprosy as we know it today, but certain skin diseases. Nuns often ran places to care for those, almost like, I suppose, a hospice in a modern way. Where somebody went to die. So females were often, in this area anyway, associated with social care, but not everywhere. Sometimes females were very powerful people indeed in the orders. You think of St. Hilda up in Whitby. She wore a mitre like a male abbot. She was a very powerful woman. She ruled over a double house of male and female religious orders, but it wasn't a man running it, it was Hilda. I think she would have been a very powerful woman indeed. So there were these powerful women. There are great names that leap out in the monastic women of St. Albans. The real important female is Christina of Marquiate, but she's not originally a monastic. She is devoted to the abbot and the monks of St. Albans, walks in every day to say prayers with them, and eventually does found her own small religious community at Marquiate.
The powerful men, you've mentioned a few of them, like Abbot John, he was fairly late.
Yeah, John's in the 1400s.
When was the heyday? I mean, was this a very successful monastery that went on and on and on until something happened?
If you look in and make a judgment, most people say the 1100s and the 1200s are the real heyday in terms of power, prestige. If you look at the manuscripts that are produced, the ones that are produced in that era are regarded some of the finest. It may have been the heyday of pilgrimage. Pilgrimage never stopped. People coming to the shrine of St. Alban. It's really important. That's the other big thing they did. In addition to praying, they cared for and made available the shrine of Alban to pilgrims. So the huge flow of pilgrims brought wealth to the monastery, but also again brought attention and prestige. It looks as if in the early 1300s, when the Black Death starts to roll around England and the plague starts carrying people off. For example, we know that in 1349, almost exactly in the middle of the 1300s, Abbot Michael Mentmore and maybe 47 of the monks are carried off by the Black Death. That's quite a blow to a house which had only probably 100 monks. You're losing almost half of your establishment. And it never seems to quite recover after that. After the 1340s, it looks as if the abbey continues to be powerful, but it never quite gets back to its glory days.
Living in close proximity and with pilgrims coming from outside is a recipe for the spreading of disease, isn't it?
People didn't understand how the plague was spread, and so there was a fear that it was airborne. There is a tradition at St. Albans that says that that big, huge stone screen that chops up the nave of the abbey from the rest was built to stop the plague, you know, spreading into the monks. That may be true. There may be those people thinking we should enclose ourselves, and it may be that the monks withdrew somewhat from the population during that period. Because remember, other people could go and deal with the population. The monastery would have had a whole host of officials. You know, we often think of monks sitting up in the watching loft, watching the shrine, but that's not quite the right picture. The officials of the monastery and some of the freemen of the city or landowners in the city, they did their duties sitting up in the watching loft. It probably wasn't the monks. So there were others who could go out in the monks' place and deal with the pilgrims. The monks could withdraw slightly.
Well, we're going to look at the relationship perhaps between the church and the state next time in a different sort of detail. We're going to focus on when the people rose up against.
Indeed, when all these objections to the monks and the abbot reached their peak.
Yes. Great. Thank you very much, David.
You're welcome. Nice to be here.